Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I sat down this week with Bill Gates. No, not that one. But another Bill Gates who I think you'll agree is well worth your time. As a leader of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors in Arizona, Gates, a Republican, endured a furious barrage of false charges, cries of betrayal, even death threats after the board certified Joe Biden as the winner, narrowly clinching for Biden the swingiest of swing states. The ordeal and its aftermath took a toll on Gates and his family and led him to seek treatment for what was diagnosed as PTSD. As we prepare for what promises to be another combustible campaign, this Bill Gates, who has shown such admirable courage in standing up for the integrity of the election system, is someone you should know. Here's our conversation. Bill Gates, it's great to see you. For those who have joined to hear a discussion about computers and philanthropy, you probably tuned in to hear the wrong Bill Gates, but instead we're talking to Bill Gates, who played a significant role in a very difficult period in our history at some great personal sacrifice. So your story is the one I'm interested in, and I'm so happy to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a real honor, and look forward to chatting with you today.
Yeah. Well, let's chat about you, the real Bill Gates. Tell me a little bit about your background, your family. I know you moved around quite a bit before you landed in Arizona. Tell me about all of that.
Yeah, sort of similar, I think, to the stories of a lot of people who have ended up here in Arizona, in Maricopa County. As a kid, I moved around a lot. My dad was in nuclear power. So, go build the nuclear power plant and move to the next place. Many states, Washington State, Louisiana, Michigan, Colorado, but landed here for high school. And so spent 4 years in high school here, which was the longest I'd lived anywhere. And this was the late 80s. This was the Reagan era. And this is when I really became particularly focused on politics and the world around me. And so
was that discussed at the dinner table? What is it that drew you in? I know you've described yourself as a kind of political geek as a kid. And that speaks to me as I was one as well, but I'm wondering what it is that sort of captured your fancy.
Yeah, I was always surrounded by it. In fact, my very first memory of politics was the 1976 election. And I remember my parents paying close attention to that presidential election. And so, I heard a lot about this, my dad being a nuclear power. I actually, as a kindergarten student, I stood up in my class, and a lot of people, we were living in Eastern Washington, the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. And so I stood up and told them that they need to go home and tell all their parents to vote for President Ford, because if they didn't, their parents were all going to lose their jobs. And so that's my kindergarten
teacher. How'd your kindergarten teacher receive that?
She was amazed and took me into the teacher's lounge and had me repeat this to all of the teachers. So, I registered as a Republican in 18, started the Teenage Republican Club at my high school. But actually, yeah, my Republican roots do go back to that 1976 election.
When you were what, 4 or 5 years old?
Yeah, I was 5 years old. So yeah. It was, I was surrounded by it. My grandpa, who couldn't be prouder of, World War II vet, and I would go over and visit him, and I would have to have, I started reading the newspaper at a very young age, but I had to read it extra close when I went out to see my grandpa, because he would quiz me. He's like, okay, How about that article on A13? You know, what are your thoughts on this?
That's tough.
Yeah, I mean, high school education, you know, just a high school education. He also spent a lot of his career in nuclear power. He was a welding superintendent out here at Palo Verde Nuclear Generating Station. So, yeah, I was always sort of surrounded by this and loved it. I mean, loved it from a very young age.
And you went to college at Drake University in Des Moines. I actually went to the University of Chicago because it was 4 years after that sort of cataclysmic convention in Chicago in 1968. And I thought Chicago was such an interesting political town, you know. And that's one of the reasons I went to the University of Chicago. Apparently, politics drew you to Drake as well.
That's absolutely right. One of the main reasons that I went there was because of course, the Iowa caucuses that I had followed throughout my childhood. And I thought, oh, this will be great. I can be involved in all of this. Unfortunately, it didn't work out the way.
There
was none. That had to be the quietest caucus ever, 1992. Of course, George H.W. Bush just rang for reelection. So no action on the Republican side. And then you had Senator Tom Harkin, the Iowa senator, running on the Democratic side. Although I do remember that President Clinton did make at least one visit there. But yeah, there was basically no action. So I was disappointed. But I was very active in the College Republicans and met a lot of people then who then took, you know, positions in the George W. Bush White House. People like Terry Nelson. Sarah Fagan, who you may know.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And I met them all through my college. So I still got some of that connection, but it was not what I've certainly heard the sort of, incredible tales you hear about meeting one-on-one with all of the candidates in the caucus.
No, I've spent a lot of time in Iowa, and it's quite an event when it's engaged. The truth is, in 92, George H.W. Bush kind of bypassed the Iowa caucus because Pat Buchanan was running, and he damn near
beat him
in New Hampshire. I think Bush was worried about getting ambushed in Iowa, as he was in 88, when Pat Robertson ran. So
that's true. That's right.
And then you went to a school in the East called Harvard Law School. I mean, obviously, it's a very esteemed school. What attracted you there?
For me, it was one of these deals where, you know, I said, hey, let's see the kind of the best law schools I can get into. I had never really spent much time on the East Coast, and I was fortunate enough to be admitted. And my dad sat me down and said, that's where you're going. You got into Harvard, you got to go. And it was really that simple. And I didn't know, you know, as a conservative Republican, if I would find many, you know, people of similar ilk. But I was fortunate enough to participate in what we call the conservative trifecta there, which is Harvard Law School Republicans, the Federalist Society, and the Journal for Law and Public Policy.
Am I right in assuming that Ted Cruz may have been there when you were there?
So Ted Cruz, I didn't meet him there. I think he was 95 grad, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, is that
so
right?
I was 96. But I can tell you while I was there in a Federalist Society meeting, Ken Starr came. Now, this was before the whole Monica Lewinsky saga, shortly before that. But he came and spoke, and actually there were probably about 10 of us who went out and had a nice Chinese meal with Ken Starr, and, you know, thoroughly enjoyed that. And so again, I'll put my conservative credentials up against anyone, although now I know those are in question with a lot of my fellow Republicans these days, but this was my background.
You've already put yourself in jeopardy by disclosing that you were for Ford over Reagan when you were five. So I'm sure someone will note that. But we went back to Phoenix after law school. You practiced law at a firm for a while. And then you took a job at a golf equipment manufacturing firm. I guess you're still associated with the same firm?
Yes, yes. So Ping Golf, been there for 22 years. Once I moved into elected office, I did move into a part-time position. to be able to do my elected position as well. But just, you know, wonderful local manufacturer here, one of the largest golf manufacturers in the world, and a family-owned business, and just has been really a great opportunity to be a part of a manufacturer that employs about 1,000 people here, you know, doing building golf clubs in America.
I don't want to jump ahead in the story, and we'll come back to this in much greater detail, but when you became the sort of target of ire by the sort of Trump right, was this a concern to your employer? Were there discussions about, gee, we should keep this on the down low, or we're going to have to kind of put you on the back burner? Or how did they react to you becoming kind of a celebrity target?
They have always been, you know, incredibly supportive of me, of my involvement in the community and in elected office. And it was no different, even though there were folks that were literally boycotting Ping because of my employment there. Some people, you know, shot some videos of folks throwing their Ping golf clubs in the lake because Bill Gates works there. But they were always very supportive because they knew that I was just doing my job. And I'm so grateful to them for that support.
That's important to have that support. So you knew, what did you know when you, early on when you returned to Phoenix, that you wanted to be engaged politically, that you might run for office? Was that something that was in your head?
That was. I didn't know if I would actually run for office, but I knew that I wanted to be involved in the community, wanted to work on campaigns, and I did that. I worked on several campaigns here over the years, including Jan Brewer, who I'm very close with. Jan Brewer actually went to
former governor.
That's right. Yeah, actually went to high school with her son, and he and I started the Teenage Republican Club back in the 1980s at Deer Valley High School.
And I was interested that as through the Maricopa Republican Party, I guess, you organized poll watchers in 2008 I assume the presidential race was the key race there. McCain and Obama were running. It's some irony in that, you know, you became the target of people who made accusations, unfounded accusations about the integrity of the election. You're, as a volunteer, you were sending people out to try and ensure the integrity of the election.
That's absolutely right. I did that through 4 cycles, 02, 04, 06, and 08. And in 06 and 08, I actually ran and organized the program for the Arizona Republican Party. And, you know, this was very important. And we always talked about this too. We were not there to intimidate voters. Although, frankly, we were, you know, we were accused of this, right? I was accused of this. My colleagues were accused of this, but it's very important. We are not there to intimidate anyone. We want to make sure that every eligible vote was counted. We wanted to make sure that all the election laws were being followed, whether in Maricopa County or one of the other 14 counties here in Arizona. So I never could have imagined that I would be facing these accusations from fellow Republicans many years later.
In 2009, you ran for the city council, which is something that's close to my heart. I'm a former city hall bureau chief and used to do a lot of races for mayors. I always thought local government was the most interesting in some ways because it's the closest to people. But I'm wondering why you chose, that's a long way from the Federalist Society at Harvard and the Harvard. Those people mostly think about being senators and governors and presidents and Supreme Court justices. I don't know that they generally think about the city council.
I think, you know, around that time, you started to see more conservatives focusing on local government, understanding that this is an area that had really been ignored, state legislative races and local races. We started seeing more of a focus on that as we got into the 2000s. And for me, I knew that I wanted to give back. I love this community, right? I've lived in so many different places. And I love this community and where I think the potential is. And at that point, we had 2 daughters. And so I thought at city council level, I could probably move the needle more than anywhere else to try and make this a community our daughters would want to come back to, right? Once they had gone to college. And I knew that this was a position I could continue to work in the private sector and be able to do the job and my employer who I went to and said, hey, would you guys support me going part-time? They said, absolutely. So the planets aligned, and I now, having worked 14 years, served 14 years in local government, I love it. I think this is, I really do think this is where the action is.
Yeah. Well, maybe a little too much action.
That's right.
It turns out. But you ran in 2016 for the County Board of Supervisors. What made you want to make that switch? Because that's where life became a lot more challenging for you.
So the irony of this was, you know, Phoenix City Council was a lot of fireworks, as you know, having that background,
yes.
And it was a very tumultuous time on the council. You started seeing things, although it's nonpartisan, becoming a lot more partisan. So when I decided to move to the county, people said, oh, that's good, Bill. It'll be a lot calmer over there, a lot quieter. But to answer your question in a serious way, the more work I did on things at the Phoenix City Council, I saw that the issues that I cared the most about, whether air quality, economic development, transportation, these were really regional questions and regional issues. And at the county level, you get to tackle it in that way. Maricopa County is the fourth largest county in the country, over 4.5 million residents. And so I thought that at that, you know, at the county level, I could really have more of that regional impact. And having this background in working on elections as a Republican lawyer, I was also, you know, silly me, I was drawn to the elections portion of the county portfolio.
And you worked on reforming the county election department with Adrian Fountas, who's now the Secretary of State, Democrat, Secretary of State of Arizona. What was your goal in reforming the election department there?
So for decades, all of the election responsibilities in Maricopa County had been in one person, one partisan elected official who had historically been Republican. But in 2016, Adrian Fontes was the first Democrat to be elected in decades. And so there was a lot of pressure on this board to say, hey, you know, this shouldn't all be in the hands of one person. Wouldn't it be better to spread that authority and responsibility across six people, the one recorder and then the five members of the Board of Supervisors? And this was a very touchy political issue, but I thought it was important. And so as chair in 2019, I sat down with Adrian Fontes. You can ask Adrian, but I think we had at least 15 to 20 meetings over, you know, shakes, and we went to Shake Shack and, you know, all these different to try and hammer this thing out.
Where all the great deals are made, yeah.
Where all the great deals are made, at least here in Maricopa County. And so we got it done, and I was very, again, I had no idea what the future would bring, but we felt like that was vitally important because there was going to be, and we know in 2018, you had a lot of Republicans saying, hey, you know, Adrian Fontes rigged this election. He rigged it for Kyrsten Sinema. Because as much of the country has gotten to know, oftentimes we may have one person leading an election on election night, but then as the votes continue to come in, it may flip. So the suggestion was even back then, well, you know, it's being rigged. And so we felt that having, as we have now and as we had then, four Republicans, two Democrats leading this effort would give people more peace of mind that, hey, this is a true bipartisan effort being led by bipartisan elected officials.
A cynic, I guess, would say you guys decided when the Democrat got the job of overseeing the elections that Republicans saw virtue in spreading the authority around.
A cynic might say that, and that may have actually been argued by some. And I understand that perspective. This is I saw this as a reform that would stick. You know, and that this is the way that we would march forward. And by the way, what we did really was just to go back to the statutory alignment that was already put in place by the Arizona legislature decades ago. It's just that the Board of Supervisors had ceded its statutory authority to the recorder and just sort of thought, hey, why don't you handle it all? Let us know how it goes. We'll approve the budget, but we're not going to get so tactically involved.
That turned out to be a fateful decision for you. Because the sharing of authority meant the sharing of the burden as well when 2020 rolled around.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, back to the show.
One of the things I'm interested in is just how well-motivated public officials trying to do their job dealt personally with the byproduct of the rage of our time. You faced another crisis, which was the pandemic. Tell me about that, because that was really when you began being targeted in a way that was beyond what people were accustomed to in politics.
Yeah, that really was when I would say everything changed. Generally, kind of having this reputation as a conservative Republican, had never had a primary up to that point, never been challenged in the primary. And then we also are the public health authority here at Maricopa County. And as I think most people know who followed these things, Maricopa County, Arizona were hit very hard by COVID. And we had some of the highest rates in the country. And so once we hit the summer of 2019, our public health officials came to us and said, we are recommending a mask mandate for Maricopa County. And that was a tough vote for all of us, but particularly the four Republicans. But we made the vote because we looked at our experts and they told us we needed to do this to save lives. We knew that was a controversial decision. We had, frankly, a lot of mayors who were calling us, asking us to take this action because they didn't want to have to make these tough votes in their jurisdictions. And I felt that it was important that we had this, you know, we took this burden on. I mean, Maricopa County is the second largest public health authority in the country after New York and LA. So there are a lot of lives on the line. And, you know, as the third largest after New York and LA, we took that seriously. But, even though knowing that this would be controversial, it did not prepare me for what would come. Shortly after that vote on the mask mandate, the mailboxes in our neighborhood, including ours, were filled with really a gruesome flyer that someone had prepared that showed me, you know, it with a whip, sort of whipping people, sort of bringing up these sort of racist stereotypes and suggesting that we were, you know, masters over our residents here when all we were doing was trying to simply keep people safe.
Talk to me about that, and particularly, and I want to come back to this a few times. You have a family, you mentioned your daughters, and you adopted a third child from Uganda. Tell me about the impact on your family of this kind of ugliness, because those flyers were meant to inflame, and they did inflame.
Yes, they did. In fact, I just There was a tweet that someone sent out in the last week where they pulled that flyer back up, and they're continuing to spread it around. But as you mentioned, we had a third daughter join the family. Our daughter, we became her permanent legal guardian in 2019, and we were thrilled. She was a sophomore in high school. And so she saw this flyer, and again, clearly racist undertones of this. And, you know, for her, that's when it really came home to me that, and you hear that, right? It's like, well, you get into politics and it has an impact on your family. And I understood that, but I never understood it like I did that day, right? And there have been many other incidents involving our daughter subsequently. And perhaps when you run for U.S. Senate, you run for the presidency, you think of yourself as living in a fishbowl, but not county board of supervisors. You don't imagine that, and you don't imagine the psychological toll that this would have on anyone, but particularly with teenage daughters. And so that's part of my story. That's part of our story as a family and how we've dealt with it, and the courage of my wife and our daughters to share our story together. I'm so proud of them for that, but I feel a lot of guilt for it too, quite frankly, because if I hadn't made that decision to run for office, they would have never had to deal with this.
And did they hear about it in school? Did they?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, this is something that they heard about. There was a particular day when there was a vote of the Arizona Senate to hold my colleagues and I in contempt.
This was around the election.
Yeah.
You wouldn't surrender the ballots.
That's right. The ballots and the tabulation machines. And, you know, I had one daughter by this point was now a freshman at Gonzaga, and she's calling, like trying to frantically get a hold of my wife. What's going on with dad? Is dad in jail? This is what I'm hearing. Another daughter, she was still in high school, and she literally, you know, heard this news and collapsed in the hallway.
Well, you had also written them, had you not prepared them for the worst? And so they were anticipating something horrible happening.
Yeah, they were. I wanted them to understand my thinking, why, you know, my colleagues and I had drawn a line in the sand here. Although we had the Arizona State Senate had subpoenaed this information, we wanted to make sure that we were not violating the law. Again, as a lawyer, I always come back to this. I felt like I've just been trying to follow the law. I'm not trying to make a political statement here. But unfortunately, in this politicized environment, you have folks going to this extent where if it were not for the courage of Paul Boyer, the one Republican state senator who voted against that resolution to hold us in contempt, we would have likely been detained, again, just for doing our job. So I was trying, I was very conscious, and my wife and I were both very conscious as parents to try and train, make sure the girls had a lesson out of this. And the lesson was that you have to stand up for what you believe in, even when it can have a negative impact on you professionally and as a person.
Yeah. We should talk about the run-up to that moment, because you saw the storm clouds gathering in 2020 as the election approached, and some of the static that President Trump was raising about sort of projectively about whether the election was going to be an honest, legitimate election or not. When did you start sort of getting concerned about that rhetoric? And when did you start worrying about what that might mean?
I was aware of the statements of President Trump that he was going to withhold judgment on whether he would acknowledge the results. But there was part of me that thought, well, is this bluster? You know, is he really going to do this? When it became real for all of us here in Maricopa County was a couple of days after the election in November of 2020, when we started seeing folks gathering outside of our tabulation center here, people like Alex Jones coming, Paul Gosar, and challenging the results. And there was a real concern that this large group, I've referred to it as Lollapalooza for the alt-right, that they might, you know, storm the tabulation center and get. Remember, this was before January 6th, 2021. And so working with our sheriff, Paul Penzone, it's just been incredible you know, able to very quickly put up some temporary protection to ensure that those election workers remain safe. But at that point, it became clear to me the rhetoric that we started hearing from Kelly Ward,
chairman of the party.
That's right. And that this was something different. But throughout it, I am an optimist. I've said that many times over the past few years. I always thought that once we got to the brink, you know, they would blink and we would move forward as we have in every other presidential election throughout the history of this country.
We should note parenthetically that Paul Penzone defeated Joe Arpaio, who very much was a person of that part of the right. And you wonder what would have happened were he in office at the time of all of this.
I've thought about that many times.
So the questions were about election machines, about just run through the category of charges that were being leveled at you, because Arizona was won by 11,000 votes. And it was, you know, it wasn't enough to tip the outcome of the election, but it was a linchpin of the election. And so 11,000 votes aren't very many. Talk about sort of the charges that were leveled and how you received them.
Yes. Yeah, so machines were really the number one and the number one objection. And this is when we started hearing about the Dominion machines, because we do use the Dominion machines here in Maricopa County. Questions, suggestions that they could flip votes, and then, you know, that Hugo Chavez, you know, built the machines, and we started hearing about, you know, Italian satellites, and there was a plane, allegedly there was a plane that came from China and landed at Sky Harbor Airport here in Phoenix with ballots that were injected. The traditional one, with your background from Chicago, you're familiar with the dead people voting. And so I had a variety of these, and Kelly Ward, on the day that we voted to certify the election, would texted me many of these allegations. As a lawyer, and as an elected official, it was my job, I felt, to track down each and every one of these allegations, as fanciful as they might seem. I was starting to understand the focus that was on Maricopa County, and that people needed to, you know, I've voted to certify many elections, both at the city council and at Maricopa County. And it's usually sort of, you know, just ministerial.
It's a ministerial, yeah.
Yeah, I knew that this was going to be different. And I felt that it was very important. And I'd like to think that this is when we started to really develop this approach of maximum transparency with Maricopa County elections. I wanted this to be a very transparent process for the people to see what questions were being raised and get answers to them.
Was your original inclination to believe that by doing that, that people would see the sort of lunacy of some of these charges and would dismiss them?
That was part of it. But honestly, it was also, let's get to the bottom of this. If our folks couldn't answer these questions, that would raise, dire concerns on my part. But they could. They did. And I was satisfied, and that's why I voted to certify the election in November of 2020.
And when you did that, did you fear for your safety? Did you fear for your family's safety?
It's interesting, because that evening, so this was back during COVID protocols, so there was no public in the auditorium. It ended up being about a 2.5 hour long meeting, again, just to certify the election, so unprecedented. But we could hear people outside of the auditorium, you know, chanting and banging on drums. It was a little unsettling, I'll admit. But as we left the auditorium, we were walked to our cars by the security services. And that, I can't remember ever having that happen before as an elected official. This was foreign to me at the time. But I thought, you know, they were just trying to be extra careful. And this was a prudent measure, but that was really the beginning in many ways of what became a new way of new normal, unfortunately, for those of us associated with elections.
You had to, from time to time, move your family from your home. You stayed in Airbnbs and other places because of threats and concerns.
Yeah, that's right. Again, this is not the sort of thing that you would anticipate at the local level, you know, Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. But we were advised to do that either we were staying in, you know, Airbnbs, undisclosed locations, or we were in our house, but we had sheriff's deputies or other law enforcement outside of the house overnight. So you just don't expect that.
No, and that must have been terrible for your kids.
It was. And, you know, each kid is different, right? And we know that. Everyone is different. Some were terrified. Some, you know, took it more in stride. But as a family, it had a significantly negative impact that no one expected.
And this went on for a long time because your state Senate, you said that the president of the state Senate, who was a Republican, told you that she knew that these charges were unfounded, but that she felt she had to carry through, presumably under political pressure and this went on for months. This led to that point where they subpoenaed the ballots, the machines and everything. And you guys drew a line and they brought in their own auditor, if you can call this outfit that, these cyber ninjas from Florida who had close ties to Trump and the Republicans, and they carried on a months long audit. And what did the audit find?
Well, after going through all that, the audit found that Joe Biden actually received more votes in Maricopa County than even we had reported in the elections department. But we now know that those were completely made up numbers. Their hand count was a farce. We know that is they have begrudgingly turned over documents, turned over text messages. This was nothing more than a grift, which I don't think any of us anticipated. This was an effort they determined to raise money and to sow further doubt about elections. And what is so sad to me is that these folks were looking for a willing, I'll say it, co-conspirator to perform an audit like this. And I'm so sad that it was my state and the state Senate here in my state that agreed to allow this to fester. And then really we started seeing folks in other parts of the country then calling for a quote, Arizona style audit, which it was no audit at all.
Hey, Bill, you must have watched this case of Dominion versus Fox News with great interest. And I'm struck by the fact that as we sit here today, 2/3 of Republicans still believe that the election was illegitimate, that it was fraudulent in some way. And a lot of that has to do with where they're getting their so-called news from or information from. And that's also, you know, outgrowths of that and right-wing media outlets is where people like you have been demonized. What's the way out? How do you free your party from that? And is there a way to free your party from that? Because you went through this again in 2022. You have a candidate for governor in your state, Carrie Lake, who lost and continues to this day to suggest, because there were some printer issues in Maricopa County, that the election was stolen from her and basically rallying people to take up arms.
Yeah, so there's a lot there to unpack. But I can tell you that I have made the decision to remain a Republican. Because I believe there are a lot of, again, the polls show that it's unfortunately a minority who believe that Joe Biden, in fact, won in 2020. It's a minority who do not believe that there's a significant amount of systemic fraud in our elections. And I place the blame primarily on the leaders of our own party. We as Republicans, you know, I thought a lot about this, and I think Republicans, we tend to be more sort of, we respect authority and kind of follow our leaders. And our leaders across the board have either raised significant questions about our elections or they've remained silent. It is such a small few of us who have raised our voices in support of the truth and in support of the safe and secure elections that we have in this country. You know, as we've been called, you know, the Maricopa Republicans. And then Rusty Bowers, of course, Adam Kinzinger, Liz Cheney. But I think that it's going to take people to have the courage to stand up and say, I'm a conservative Republican, perhaps, you know, I'm pro-life. These are all the things I believe in. And oh, by the way, I also think we have safe and secure elections. I think that Joe Biden won in 2020, and I think we can beat Joe Biden in 2024 for the following reasons. It's up to us. I continue to, you know, people say this democracy is in peril. Well, the only way we get out of this is through the Republican Party, through the Republican Party having a true discussion about who we are, what we believe in, supporting the truth. And do I think it's easy? No, it's going to be very, very difficult.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. Celebrities of all kinds are speaking publicly about their therapeutic trips, so to speak. It turns out there is a burgeoning industry ready to serve the new influx of people who find themselves turning away from traditional mental health therapy. The gap between what we know and what we don't about psychedelic therapy. Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to the show. On Kerry Lake, given the death threats that you've had, and given your concerns about your, not just yourself, but your family, what do you think when she repeatedly invokes the Second Amendment and maybe it's time and so on? Because the inference isn't even subtle.
Yeah, I have great concern by this, the normalization of sort of political violence or the suggestion of political violence, regardless of wherever these are Republicans or Democrats. And I'm particularly disappointed in my fellow Republicans who do not call this out. I've done that. My colleagues have done that. We'll continue to do that. We can debate the issues. We can have a hard-nosed debate. I think that's great. I think that's how we get to good public policy in many ways. But invoking political violence, this is not a game. And it has to stop before someone gets hurt. We are focused here in Maricopa County on keeping our elections workers safe and our voters safe. But, you know, my colleagues and I are actually victims in prosecutions that are going on right now of folks because words are not, words are real. Words inspire people to do things, and violations of election laws by, you know, people threatening elections officials, they're being taken seriously, both by the Department of Justice and here on the local level. So I'll take this opportunity once more to call upon all folks in elected office and candidates to knock it off before someone gets hurt or even killed.
Do you think that she's someone who should be in some way held accountable for her words, or is the election's enough?
I think that, again, I'm not a prosecutor. By trade, I'll leave that to the prosecutors to decide whether crimes have been committed. But I can tell you, as a human, this is wrong. This is wrong to suggest that, one, we are all committing crimes, because that's what she and many others have suggested, that we're committing crimes, that we're rigging elections. And then tying that to suggesting that you know, we need to be hung, we need to be shot, we need to be poisoned. It's not just her. It's other Republican politicians in this state who have done it. And it needs to stop now. And my fellow Republicans need to start speaking out against it more.
The question is whether you think that that Republican Party still exists, or at least exists in numbers that are adequate.
I think that it can still be done. I think that there is enough of those folks who have sort of bought into this denialism, who can still be brought around. But, it's not going to be easy. This is a long-term project. But as many people say to me, and I couldn't agree more, this democracy must have two healthy parties to be successful.
I believe that myself. We have this mutual friend, Rusty Bowers, who is the, I can call him a friend now because he's not running for anything. I don't want to destroy his political career.
But I came to know him after he displayed such courage as the Speaker of the House in standing, facing down the President of the United States, who wanted him to do things that were inappropriate to try and tilt the election after the fact in his direction. But he ran for the state Senate after having done that, and he lost handily, 2-1. Isn't that sort of where the Republican Party is now? I mean, Donald Trump, as we sit here today, is under 2 indictments with maybe more pending and is still the front runner for your party's nomination.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was very disappointed to see Rusty lose his race. We did have in that same ballot, Tom Galvin, who's one of my colleagues on the Board of Supervisors, who was successful in a primary. Now, he had about 40% of the vote. And so the folks on the sort of the election deniers that he was running against, the three of them, they split the vote. So much in the same way that Donald Trump has taken advantage of the first past the post, winner take all primaries, I think that those could be used in to support those like me who believe in the truth. But it's going to take some luck, right? We need some races like this where there's sort of one of us and 3 or 4 of those who are election deniers.
And yet you're not running again.
So I'm not running again, but I think it's important for people to understand why I'm not running again. This is not an admission that I think I can't win. This is someone here who's served in locally elected office for 14 years. At the end of this term, I will have had 8 years on the Board of Supervisors. I've never viewed myself as a professional politician, right? I have other things that I want to do in my life. If I would have run for re-election, I'll admit it would have been a tough race as, running as a Republican. But this is not an admission that I can't win an election. It's a much more complicated calculus, much more complex calculus that includes wanting to spend a little bit more time with my family after all that our family has been through.
Well, I want to ask you about what you've been through, because one of the other great interests of mine is mental health. And you've been very open about your struggles around these controversies and these pressures, starting with the pandemic and what happened around it, and through all of these trials involving the elections. Talk to me about that journey, about your own mental health.
Yeah, this has been very difficult for me. I am someone who has, I have identified, as you've heard in this podcast, I've identified as a Republican since the earliest memories that I have. I've identified as hopefully someone with integrity, who believes in following the law, the rule of law. And through all of this, that has been questioned over and over again, and questioned many times by my friends, my political allies. And over time, I became more and more bitter about what was going on. I was, someone who not only, organized these poll workers, but I really helped build a cadre of Republican election lawyers that the party could look to help ensure the integrity of the elections process. And then to have these people question me, make these awful allegations, and then to not really have my friends stand up for me at all, I became very bitter. And then you compound that with the death threats that we dealt with as a family. I found myself, and I didn't even realize it was going on, but my wife made it very clear to me that I was losing, who I was. I was distracted. I was bitter. I was not the man, the husband and the father that I had once been. And then I started to, as COVID restrictions came down, I started to attend more and more events with people like the former president of the Senate, Karen Fan, who was a friend of mine who I had worked with on many issues. But now I had been dealing with her as someone suggesting that my colleagues here and the elections workers in Maricopa County and I were violating the law. We were engaging in election fraud. And so I'd go to these events. I couldn't even go up and talk to her, but I'd be in side groups and I would become enraged. And that was not me. That's not me. I was sort of always known as the level-headed guy. That's what I think people liked about me. I wasn't that level-headed guy anymore. I had so much hate and anger. And then it really all came to a head in 2022 when one of my colleagues here, our county attorney, Alistair Adell, she tragically passed away. And so I was at her funeral. I spoke.
She's quite young and she's under a lot of pressure herself.
Yes.
For other reasons. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so I went to the reception after that funeral and saw many of my Republican allies who I hadn't seen in person in quite a while. And one of them in particular, one of my fellow Republican election lawyers, I started to talk to him about it. And he said, you know, I just find all of this stuff, this alleged election fraud, all just very boring. And something, you know, it just lit a fire inside of me. And my wife was with me and she grabbed me by the arm and said, you got to stop this. You need to go to therapy. I don't know who you are. I don't know this man standing in front of me. And so within a week, I was in therapy, never gone to therapy before. And we know the stories of, particularly as men, right? We're told, suck it up, right? Rub some dirt on it and move on. Mm-hmm. Particularly an elected official, right? Viewed as kind of a sign of weakness. What's wrong with you? Is there something wrong?
A character defect, yeah.
Yes. And so I did it, but I did it online, right? I wasn't going to go out and march into a psychologist's office, but I did it online because I felt comfortable with it. And wow, what a difference. What a difference it made for me. I didn't realize how much I needed this. And to hear from my therapist that I had PTSD, which I winced at. You know, I'm like, I don't have PTSD. You know, this is politics, right? First responders have PTSD. Veterans, you know, Vietnam veterans of the wars in the Middle East. This wasn't PTSD, but for the first time, you know, I heard someone tell me that. And in some ways it gave me peace that, you know, this is tough what I'm dealing with, this trauma, and I need to accept that and start to address it.
And you've made progress, obviously. And has your family healed some from this as a result of what you've done?
Yes. Yes, most definitely. So this was earlier in 2022, and I'm very happy that I had gone to therapy because we, as you alluded to, you know, in the 2022 election in November 2022, there's really kind of the eyes of the world on us here in Maricopa County. But as a family, we've spoken so openly about this, and I give my wife great credit for that because that's the type of mom she is. That's the type of wife she is. And so we have done a lot of healing. It's an ongoing process, of course, as a family, but I'm so proud of my wife and our daughters for supporting me, telling me, reminding me, Dad, there's no shame in this at all. So not only was I willing to take it on, but then, you know, instead going out and talking about it. And you know, I love sports, right? I'm a big Phoenix Suns fan.
Yeah.
And so the way that I've tried to look at it, it's like, hey, Devin Booker, Kevin Durant, they got to get ready for the big game, right? So maybe it's either they have a sports therapist or they need to work with the trainer. And it's the same way here. This helped me to get ready for these big moments, like in November of 22, when we had the eyes of the world on us, because people don't want to see their elections official as someone who's, you know, losing their temper, but instead as someone who's ready to defend the elections workers, but also to go out when something, you know, go out there and tell the truth when something like we had, you know, the challenges with the tabulators, that it was going to be all right. And here's how you can still ensure that your vote is counted. By the way, everyone's vote was counted and no one was disenfranchised.
There are some things you said that were so important, but I just want to underscore the importance of recognizing that we're all subject to mental illness. We're all subject to these moments of stress and anxiety that can be really distorting and destructive. And it is not a weakness of character to get some help. It's important to get help to sort these issues out and to find the light. So good for you in doing that. And I hope everyone who's listening will think about that example, because so many people could benefit who don't and ultimately find themselves in tragic circumstances. So I appreciate that. I want to ask you two things before we go. One is about others who are thinking of running for public office. They'll hear your story, and the question is, why should I subject myself to this? Politics has become so ugly. Social media, polarization, you try and do the right thing, you become a target. As someone who believes deeply in democracy, what is your honest answer to these folks?
So my honest answer to that would be that you need to understand it's not easy, that you could very well be subjected to these challenges, these threats, even at the local level. But I can tell them, if they care about this country, if they care about our democratic republic, there's nothing like having the opportunity to be there in a moment where a lot is on the line. And there's no other way I can imagine that you can learn more about yourself and what you're made of than being in those positions. No matter, you know, what the history books say about this time, I know what I did. I know what my colleagues did in this difficult time. And all of this money and, you know, personal prestige that you might get from a job in the private sector, there's nothing like serving your country, serving your community. And if all of us who care deeply about this decide to check out, we know who will be left in these positions. And that concerns me. I'm taking a break at the end of 2024, but I absolutely intend to continue to serve my community. I don't know what that role will be, but I just want people to know, for those of us who decide, you know, not to run again, it doesn't mean we're quitting. It doesn't mean we're giving up. You have to take a break sometimes too. But I encourage those people who are interested in running for office, do it. There's nothing more rewarding than public service.
And here's a related question that I think is really important as we look forward to another potentially combustible presidential election just around the corner. You know, you read stories from around the country about election workers who are frankly intimidated and concerned for their safety and their reputations, and there being recruitment problems for election workers. And you also see stories about election deniers seizing the election machinery in counties around the country. How concerned are you about that and about the integrity of the next election? Not because the system is inherently corrupt or corruptible, but because good people are afraid to participate as election officials, and because election deniers are grabbing the wheel.
So I always want to be very careful about labeling people who might be interested in serving in elections. We need to have everyone working in elections, regardless of what their political views may be. So I think that's very important, not only because this is, you know, we need to have folks from both parties, eyeballs from, and that's very important to the process. But also I've found we've had the experience where people have come in the door sort of convinced that the system, there's systemic fraud. As they learn more, they come to learn that it's not. And they can be evangelists for this. So we've seen some of that. But do I have concerns about 2024? Absolutely. I know that we've seen this in some other counties and other states where people who have run on almost this, you know, platform of trying to put their finger on the scale have been elected. But in the end, because there are so many different eyeballs on the system, I've got confidence. The other thing that we're doing here in Maricopa County is we're doing tabletop exercises for insider threats. We're very much focused on that. We have 24/7 live stream cameras on our election facilities. So that should give confidence to those who on the right and the left who think that there's funny business going on. But we will continue to watch these things very carefully. I know that that needs to happen across the board. But the other thing, maybe to kind of end on an optimistic tone, is that as we know, there are some people who decided not to participate in elections as workers because of fears. Well, I've also met people, particularly young people, who've come up to me and they said they've been inspired now by what they've seen to pursue a career in elections administration. I can tell you 10 or 20 years ago, that didn't happen. You go to these elections conferences and pretty much everyone you ask, how'd you end up in elections? They're like, it was an accident. You know, I don't know how I ended up in it, but I love it. And now those same people, you know, the folks who become first responders, who run into burning buildings, like we saw in 9/11, we're starting to see some of those people who are actually inspired to pursue a career in elections administration. So that gives me hope.
That's a great optimistic note to stop on. And look, I say it all the time, democracy is an ongoing battle between hope and cynicism. And
That's right.
We can't surrender to cynicism. And you did not, Bill Gates, and you deserve great respect and gratitude for that. You certainly have mine. And I appreciate spending this time with you.
Well, thank you so much, David. Really wonderful to share the story. And thank you for taking the time to have me join you today.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Miriam Finder Annenberg. The show is also produced by Jeff Fox and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.